This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In order to begin, what I wanted to do is just simply evoke a passage from an interview that Shayla Sheikh had with Fazel. In relation to the This Place exhibition, which is right now at the Brooklyn Museum of Art, which is displaying part of the Desert Bloom section of the project. I should say that the exhibitions all take their point of departure from Fazel's The Erasure Trilogy, which is three-volume photographic set. The first volume is called Memory Trace, so this exhibition draws its images from that part of the project. Desert Bloom is now being shown at the Brooklyn Museum of Art and also its Thought Foundation. And then Independence Nakba will open tomorrow at the Pace McGill Gallery. So these are the three parts of the exhibition, of the project. And in relation to the This Place exhibition, in relation to the Desert Bloom project, Shayla asked Fazel to talk about the role and place of questions of legibility and interpretation in relation to the aerial images that compose the Desert Bloom project. And in answer to the question, Fazel states, "The interesting thing is how the photograph can be used as a kind of archaeology. It's a pause along a continuum. It holds within it everything that you need to access, but one also needs a trained eye to unravel what it is you are looking at. The work is an elegy to something that is passing, being transformed. All of the photographs I made," he adds, "are traces not only of the moment that I photographed them, but also the traces which lie just below the surface from some other time, sometimes going back as far as prehistory to Nabataean era or Byzantine era inventories, or to the remains of recent demolitions in Bedouin villages, including, in fact, the Bedouin still living within the landscape under threat of eviction. In this sense, they are traces of what is already fading, bearing witness not only to a certain presence, but also to the tide of transformation." What Fazel suggests here, and what I think will be demonstrated by the comments you're about to hear this evening, is that a photograph is not simply a record of a particular moment, but also a kind of archive. An archive in an entire network of historical relations, some of which are more legible than others, but all of which would be necessary if we were to read this or that particular image in its entirety. What's always moved me about Fazel's images is the way in which they tell us that memories never appear alone, and that every single memory is itself already multiple and multiply related to other memories, none of which are ever just one. This evening, we're joined by Sadia Abbas, Amira Haas, Emmett Gowan, Rashid Khalidi, Rosalind Morris, Shayla Sheikh, and Michael Wood. Susan Mizelas also was supposed to be here this evening, but she sent her regrets that in the end, she's unable to be here with us. We've made a sheet available with all of the bios of tonight's speakers that should be at the table also at the entrance. So I hope you've all picked one of those up too. So before turning the stage over to our guests, each of whom will speak in alphabetical order, I just want to invite Fazel to say a few words, not only about the genesis of the project, but also about this particular exhibition.
I don't wish to insert myself too greatly into the evening because I'm so honored by this group of individuals, intellectuals, who have come to share their thoughts about the images. And in a sense, I think what I might be able to offer in a small, sort of short, anecdotal fashion is the genesis of the project as a whole. Because it started from a visit I made in 2010, not sure if I would be able to work in Israel-Palestine, and spent two or three visits moving across the divide between Israel and the West Bank, visiting with families, interviewing people, and it seemed to me the most pressing issue, or the one that was in line with my own sensibilities, was that which somehow approached the legacy of 48. I began by interviewing combatants on both sides of the divide, Israelis and Palestinians, Arabs who lived also in the Arab-Israeli towns in the north, and I was looking for a means by which to find a toehold, a starting point. And the curious thing was that many of the Israelis would speak about how when they were children they were speaking Arabic, living side by side with many of the people they would grow later to hate and fight against. And one afternoon, speaking with an older commander, he told me about a site of battle at Latrun. And I grew curious to visit the site. And on doing so, I then wanted to visit more of the sites of battle, but also to begin to sort of piece together the spaces that had been not only sites of battle, but had been villages that were latterly evacuated and people basically sent to exile into the Arab-Israeli towns in the north or across the borders. And what I found curious in beginning to research these places was that so many of them had been subsumed within the land, the traces of them either actively in attempts to cover over the legacy of what was there, or transformed, reimagined as archaeological sites from another era. This was not really new research in any way, but it was something that really resonated with the trajectory of my own work. And then slowly I began to imagine that it would be of interest to try and find the people who had at one time lived in those spaces. And so I began moving across the border from Israel into the occupied territories. And in a way, in finding the people who lived in that space all these years ago, now they were in their 70s, 80s, 90s, some were in excess of 100 years old, I realized that I was able to, in a way, be a kind of conduit between the place left behind, remembered, and the place which the people inhabit today. And this was a very odd, perhaps it was also a question of permission, right? Somebody from outside had the opportunity to move with a degree of fluidity between one community and the next. And this, I think, was potentially a slight advantage. But what I found really extraordinarily poignant for me in those moments, and a great kind of responsibility, was the idea that people would send me back to villages looking for certain things or describing in great detail what that space had meant to them when they were yet but children. And so when I visit this exhibition, which we've just finished hanging, I see these images, these landscapes, the portraits. The portraits are, in a way, landscapes in themselves. The fissures of their faces, in a way, give a hint of that which is held within. And for me, that was extremely touching to witness. And as I put it together into the first volume in this trilogy, one led to the next. But in a sense, I felt as though people would ask me what kind of final statement I had to make about the place. And I think, in a way, somebody who comes as a visitor for 5 years hasn't really the right to assert a final solution for a place that has such great complexity. What I'm interested in most of my work is the idea that viewing an exhibition or reading a book embroils the viewer in this kind of same sort of engagement I have with both the people rendered in the images and the landscapes. And so I see the books as a kind of a starting point, an invitation to a conversation. And in that way, I mean, in that way, tonight is really exceptional for me, because though I will see these images in a very particular way, I'm in a sense burdened by the way in which I've experienced being there and knowing these people, I'm delighted at the idea that the work has a life of itself beyond my experience, that this panel will read and interpret and understand things that I either failed to see or that were not in sync with my own understanding. They broaden and they expand upon that starting point. So I thank you all for being with us tonight. And
I've been asked to respond to one of the images without any specific directive and from where I stand. So I hope you will bear with me if I take fully the license afforded by the invitation and let myself be led by the image. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Eduardo Cadava, Fazal Sheikh, and the Storefront Museum for this particularly wonderful invitation. And I say wonderful because I just let myself go and didn't have to write an academic talk. I didn't understand why I was so drawn to this photograph. In a way, it seemed anomalous. The trees in light are beautiful, almost pastoral. The rubble is scattered and given its scale, not terribly obtrusive. The image seemed, within the context of the series, particularly opaque, to me at least. I wondered if I were merely drawn to it because it was more palatable, because it was in its evocation of nature and the picturesque somehow easier to see. Then I realized that it was inviting me to think about a lifelong preoccupation that has everything to do with the constitutive role of the English poetic tradition in my formation, which is, of course, that of a colonial growing up in Pakistan. I kept thinking of bowers and glades in English poetry, utopian, Edenic, places of shelter and shade, of dappled light and a comfort afforded by nature. In this context, the word glade seemed more precise, and so I found myself reaching for the Irish Yeats. Quote, I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow. End of quote. And I realized that it was the terrible and painful irony of this rubble in this glade that drew me to the photograph. The photograph's fleeting capture of light on paper, dappled and danced with trees and leaves and shade, is a testament for me to the absence of shelter and peace in this shade. And I find myself thinking, by contrast, of the murderous heat and light of the sun in Ghassan Kanafani's Men in the Sun, sorry for the pronunciation, and of the quest for peace rendered in concentrated and paradoxical images of beauty in Adania Shibley's Touch, stories about the absence of peace and shade for the stateless, for the refugee. The image is also a reminder of the weaponization of nature in late modernity. Along with this image, I think of the aerial photographs and their grim addition of meaning to the phrase, making the desert bloom. And I think also of the assault on nature itself in the uprooting of some olive trees, while at the same time planting olive trees is transformed into an eager goal. The olive tree then is both tagged for destruction and made into an agent of eradication. This park on these ruins reminds me also of the evacuation of blacks from public space and the complex history of American parks. At the same time, I think of the history of enclosure, the early modern British history of enclosure, which led Marvell to write the Moa poems, themselves produced out of the assault on and management of nature and modernity. And within the vein of this historical trajectory, I find myself also thinking of the haunting image of the abandoned house, the next one, and the forlorn trees next to it, emblems of the lives removed and forced away from that house and that little bit of land, reminding me of other abandoned or reconstituted spaces and their relation to colonialism, imperial dissolution, and emergent nationalisms. A Lahore empty of Sikhs, abandoned in, quote, Greek Christian houses in Jinda and Asia Minor, now Turkey, the ruined village of Klapados on the island of Lesvos, the way in which Lord Curzon's dreadful notion of the, quote, unmixing of populations, probably inspired by thinking behind the partition of Bengal, was deployed in the context of the population exchange between Greece and Turkey in the early 20th century, which would become one of the precursors for arguments defending the partition of India and the creation of Pakistan, which in turn, as Faisal Devji has recently shown in his brilliant book on Pakistan, Muslim Zion, was a precedent cited in defense of the Zionist state of the United Nations. The rubble in this park, like the house forcibly evacuated, is an effect of the emphasis on, quote, unmixing, segregation, apartheid, racialization that are so fundamental to colonial modernity, and that, first practiced in the colonies, were then applied to Europe's own populations during the Holocaust. My emphasis on the term modernity here is in no way intended to downplay the violence of Ottoman imperial rule, and I say this because I'm working on Greece right now, and what's being done to Greece is so terrible, but instead, to remember the way in which indigenous forms of older social organization in modern life have been under increasing assault or attack for hundreds of years, aided by the globalizing logic of settler colonialism. And so we see the assault on the Bedouins in the Negev in the Desert Bloom photographs. To return then to the image of the park, the site's ancient, in quotes, title, the text tells us, is Hurbat Ovi, Ovi Ruin, reminding us of the modern world's oscillation between monumentalization and erasure, revivalism and eradication, the erasure of history in the name of history, of which the nation state is a particular and brutal instantiation. Another instantiation is to be found in the curation and discourse of the ruin, of the picturesque element in ruin gazing, which is put to use in the service of an entire epistemological structure of difference and superiority. I'm thinking, of course, of Greco-Roman ruins. To conclude, in his poem Station Island, Seamus Heaney, poet of another partition, wrote a line of accusation addressed to the aestheticizing poet and artist, quote, "You confused evasion and artistic tact," end of quote. What is remarkable to me about the photographs in these series is that they are not evasive and yet preserve an artistic tact, which is to say, among other things, that they preserve the dignity of those who have suffered, do not succumb to a pornography of pain, as they work complexly together in an aesthetics of witness and what I prefer to call justice. Moreover, in this image, the subtle destabilization of a picturesque aesthetics of evasion, a destabilization facilitated by the photograph's place in the series and by the powerful interplay of language, narrative, and image, leads me to the question, how do we think about, what do we do with, how do we see this atrocity, this pain, this rubble, and this glade? Thank you.
Well, my name is Emmett Gowan, and Fuzzle Sheikh and I have known each other for over 30 years. So my perspective is a somewhat awkward perspective. But it is a pleasure to be here and to give what witness, bear what witness I can to the authenticity of this person. I've known Fuzzle both as a student and as a colleague all these years, and I would be remiss if I didn't make a point about that summer between his junior and senior year when returning once again, as he had done every year as a child, to Kenya. He came back to the university transformed with a new language about a new subject, which in the end was the truth of his own life. Now, I wanted to talk about the aerial photographs in particular, since that's something I have a lot of feeling about. But when I studied this picture, which had lots of levels of connection to me personally, because I had actually had an engagement with the Nebatean people, and this was a Nebatean village, probably 2nd, 3rd century before Christ. I was also ruminating on the discussion around the issue of whether or not aerial photographs needed a special education in order to be experienced or understood, all of which took me to the wonderful thought of T.S. Eliot that a poem can communicate before it's understood. And I would like to say an image can also communicate. And you need not, in the end, understand. And I want to dispel the notion that you need any special knowledge or experience to be a witness to what you can learn from an aerial photograph, from any image, from any work of art. I'm really advocating the dispensing with the middleman. And I wondered if Fuzzle would recall. I said, I don't want to just speak about your picture. I could go into details of this picture. But I wondered, when you were a student, do you remember seeing this? It has deep personal meaning for me because as a young person wanting to be a painter, I'd been given a book in which this picture appeared. And I'm sure I did not understand it. My personal experience was one of confusion. There was a title, and I'm denying you that for just a moment. It's very nice to not know what you're looking at. It's a really honest place to begin. But this thing can communicate. And one of the questions I love to ask the students about this picture, did human beings make this? Or did the insects or some other animal, what creature could have been the instrument of this event? And I call it an event, perhaps because I know things like this must be complex, don't just happen instantaneously. It's not a meteor striking the Earth. And I struggled with this image a long time until I realized that there was a linguistic, pictorial element in our knowledge, which whoever or however or whatever instinct drove the making of this event to be the holder of images, and the spiral, the circle, is the image held. I'm going to tell you what it is. It turns out that it is an airfield, which was being used by the Germans in northern part of Libya during World War II. This is an RAF photograph showing the damage done by German soldiers who plowed up the airfield so the English would be unable to use the airfield. Now you know something. But you already knew there was something of the wild insect in the human brain that did this act. You almost can say, I can feel where it started, because out of that first act, the other acts follow. One thing fits into the last thing. You could not, there must be a sequence in which this unfolds. And you get to places in the very periphery where the central theme or idea of absolute destruction is driving the man who's driving the tractor. And he's absolutely determined to do a perfect job of destruction. And out on the periphery, you see he repeats the motif, but he no longer is possessed by conviction. Now, I want to keep this short. I just have to say, anyone who wants to understand the authenticity of Fuzzel should look at the portraits. The portraits are where Fuzzel found himself. And I think it's where you can also find him now. And you can find the equilibrium that, like our genetic code, makes us all part of the same oneness. There's one more. You can visit with the coordinates that Fuzzel so tenderly recorded. You can revisit these sites, each of them on Google Earth. I was pleased to see, Fuzzel, that my version of Google Earth came up with a different image than yours. And so here's the same event witnessed by another device. This almost a non-human device. It's impossible to say. One more, change once more, and back to the image. And I think it is Jacques Monod in a beautiful book called The Poetics of Form, who reminds us that a village is like an egg, is like a nest. They're all the same.
Good evening. I'm Amira Haas. I thank you, Eduardo and Fuzzel, for inviting me. I was not... They took the opportunity that I was here in town. And for me, this is home. It is home because I was born in Israel, and because since early childhood, we always noticed those mute houses and the vegetation around them, untouched but empty. And it was part of the normal landscape. And maybe now you cannot see that it is beautiful, But I very easily can imagine how beautiful it is, especially in springtime, with all yellow and flowers and the grass and the birds. It doesn't look beautiful now. It looks beautiful in other times, but maybe also now. If you just relate to it as home. I didn't know this place. I knew some other places. I went to some similar emptied houses with the people who were born in the villages. It is not a new experience. Yet, after I lived in Gaza for 3 years, I started much more to connect each village to the people who came from the village and that I came to know in the refugee camps of Gaza. I once had a woman who was born in one of the villages not far away from there, Brer, and she's a refugee now in Jabalia, and she was visiting her daughter in Ramallah, and I took her home to Gaza Strip, and through the way she related, every tree told her what village was there when she was a child. And every such empty house, which are not many, on the road told her. And looking at this, I ask myself, and looking at the beauty that I see in it, I ask myself, does a place remain beautiful? Or does beautiful remain beauty? Does beauty remain beauty? Where it is so absorbed by expulsion, by the emptying of people, by the disappearance of people, can a place remain beautiful even though it witnessed expulsion, even though it witnessed so much sorrow? And this is a question that I don't, of course, ask only there. I must say that I ask it also here, for example, in the States, when I take the train and we pass through rivers, and the sight is very beautiful. And I ask myself the same question. I always see the Native Americans there. I guess it's images that come to me from all kinds of old films, but I do see them. I do see, and I ask myself the same question. When I think that the river is beautiful, do I contaminate the beauty by thinking that it is beautiful? Because this means I disregard the absorption of so much injustice that is there. So much mute injustice now after so many centuries. And there is another question that I have. And that's where I find that even less articulate. When we look at such scenes or photos, we know that there are people who were there, that there are thoughts of people who were there, that there are feelings of people who are there, exchange of thoughts between people whose house belongs to them or to the village where they lived. But we, I allow myself to speak in the we, the articulated class, don't we appropriate those thoughts and feelings and exchange of longing that people must have been exchanging among themselves over the decades since the expulsion? So don't we appropriate unjustly when we try to speak instead of them? That's why I think that the photograph is so much superior to my very words, because it allows the imagination to the emptiness that the imagination here is involved with allows those words and exchange of thoughts and feelings that we don't hear to come and instead of us. Thank you, Fazil.
Well, I want to thank Eduardo for, and Fazel, of course, for Eduardo for inviting me, and Fazel for these wonderful images. I feel a little out of place here, actually. An image like this deserves a more artistic and more aesthetic response than I'm going to be able to give it. I have the misfortune of being a historian. And we have the misfortune of being, to some extent, all of us, mindless empiricists. And so this is a beautiful and evocative image. When I first received it, I was traveling. And I didn't answer Eduardo for weeks. He kept sending me more and more urgent emails. And I have a terrible habit. If an email requires 10 or 15 minutes and I don't have 10 or 15 minutes, I leave it in my inbox. So I didn't really look carefully at the images until about a week ago. And when I did, I didn't do all the downloading I should have done. So I didn't see the captions for any of the images. And I picked this one because I thought I know which village it was from. And being a historian and being a mindless empiricist and being from Jerusalem and knowing that it was almost undoubtedly a village near Jerusalem, I was thinking Lifta or Ein Kerem. It is Lifta, actually. But I didn't know that when I thought about the image. I said, let me take this one. And I looked at it and I looked at it. And I very strongly suggest after we're all done and the lights go back on, it's about midway down the wall, you get up close to it and you look at it very, very carefully. And I'm going to tell you a few things about the image and a few things about the place. You'll notice that most of the scenes, that there are three sets of things that Fuzzit has done with this series. One are diptychs of images of one person and another person born in the same year, one Israeli, one Palestinian. Another are aerial photographs, one of them you saw just before. And most of them that are here are from the series of erasures of mainly places, but also people. And most of these, you will notice, are either of individual abandoned houses or individual ruined houses or a scene like the one that Saadia talked about, a demolished village with trees. There are very few cases where you have as many intact but abandoned houses as here. And this is an anomaly, Lifta, because in 1948, about 400 of these villages were overrun and their populations forced out during what Palestinians call the Nakba, or the catastrophe. And most of those villages had two things happen to them. The overwhelming majority of them, sometimes immediately, in most cases in the subsequent years, were destroyed. The land was taken away, and as you can see from the captions to the photographs on the walls, taken by neighboring Jewish agricultural settlements. But the buildings were by and large destroyed, and if any were allowed to remain, they were one or two, sometimes a mosque, sometimes a room kept as a storeroom, and so on. This is one of the few cases where, in fact, almost an entire village was left in place. And it's unique in that it is still there. It's there for bureaucratic reasons that are laid out in Eduardo's, in Fazel's description. You can read it there. I'm not going to go into it. But this is a picture, if you can turn your mind's eye back to the past, look at the cactus growing at the edge of the village. Look at the cactus growing. It's wild here. It was tamed and controlled when people lived here. Look at the trees. Some of these are fruit trees. Some of these would be other kinds of trees for shade. All of this would have been controlled. All of this would have been managed. All of this would have been in repair. Think of it as it might have been. You can't do that with most of the other villages because, as I say, they've been destroyed. But look very carefully at this image when you have a chance later. You'll see something quite extraordinary right here. And that is a woman with a black veil covering her hair, sitting on what looks like a mattress between two completely deserted houses. Now, as Fazel's excellent description of the village, which I didn't see until this afternoon, will tell you, this village is completely abandoned except for a few people who still live in it, drug addicts, squatters, and so on and so forth. But if you look carefully at the houses, they are clearly mostly empty. So we have no idea who this woman is. I'd like to think that she's a woman from Lifta. She looks like an older woman. I like to think that she's someone who might have been a child at the time that the village was abandoned. And it was, the people were driven out in February, mainly, of 1948. And I like to think that she comes there and meditates and thinks about what she sees in her mind's eye of the village that she grew up in. If she's not from Lifta, she looks to me old enough to be from another of these villages, maybe Ain Kerem, maybe Qastal, maybe Deir Yassin, in the western, what is now the western suburbs of Jerusalem. And she's completely out of place, if you look at it, but she's the only thing in the village that's in place, because in the background, it's almost invisible in this image, but it's very clear if you get up close to the image on the wall over there. You see marching across the hilltops the modern Israeli housing. It's always on a hilltop. Always. Palestinian villages are in the valley, on the sides of the hills. There's a different architecture. They meet the landscape differently. Israeli villages are always on the top of the hill. They dominate. They control. They're there. They want to make sure that nobody can come up at them. And you can see them along the top of the neighboring hill. So this is a different kind of village. In the background is what we have today in much of the landscape. And in the foreground is what's left of the presumably the fruit trees and the orchards that the people of Lifta once cultivated. I know a number of people from Lifta. And they're among the very few Palestinians. There are a few others whose homes still exist in towns and villages. Very, very few. But they're among the few Palestinians, the majority of whom lived in villages like this, whose original houses are actually still in being. And it's particularly painful because this village is on the road down from Jerusalem to the coast. Anytime you go down, or anytime you go up, if you're going up, it's on your left. If you're going down, it's on your right. They see the houses of the village that they once lived in. I don't know which is worse, to have to visit the site of your original home destroyed in as it is in the image that you showed us, or to see your original home in this form. Let me say one last thing, which is inspired by something that Amira said to me before we started, which is that we're very, very lucky in 2016. 20 or 30 years ago, we couldn't have had a photographer like this doing something like this, exhibiting something like this in a place like this, enabling an audience like you to have access to these experiences. These were experiences that were not talked about, could not be talked about, and here we have an opportunity in a particularly rich environment. I thank everybody who is involved in this to have access to this. If you read these captions, you will learn more than anybody ever was allowed to learn for decades and decades after 1948. So I want to thank you, Fazal. I want to thank you, Eduardo. I want to thank you and the gallery for doing this. This is a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's a wonderful thing aesthetically. It's a wonderful thing in terms of these beautiful, beautiful images. But it's also a wonderful thing in terms of values like justice and truth and understanding and knowledge. Thank you.
I want to join my colleagues here in thanking our hosts, Ava and the storefront. Can you hear me? Am I audible? Great. Thank you, Ava and the storefront, for hosting this extremely important and compelling event. Thank you, Eduardo, for the very generous invitation that includes me in this fabulous lineup of people, thinkers and artists. And, of course, thank you, Fazal, for this remarkable, magnificent body of work, for your indefatigable devotion to art and intervention, and for your insistence on their mutual entailment rather than reduction to each other. I'm going to return us to an image that you have already seen and that's already been spoken about in related but different ways. You know from the captions and from what has been said that this is an aerial photograph of a village, Rehovot, in the Negev. You have its cartographic location. But I want to start differently by trying to describe it. In doing so, if I ask you to just look at the perimeter of that image, I'll ask you to think for a moment about why it is that an allegory tempts me, thanks to the ghostly trace of a human skull that seems to emerge, mirage-like, in the contours of the settlement whose destruction provides the historical background for that image. I realize that this may be an anthropologist's predilection, but if you look in the outlines of that village, something of that arises. But to indulge that conjuration would be to leave the photograph behind. And this is, above all, a photograph. As such, the photograph, I would say, says nothing, tells me nothing, proves nothing. And yet, if it is mute, it is not silent, or at least it bids a response. Questions gather there, where the grain of the photograph and the grain that is sand coalesce. Medium and referent fold over on each other in this and many other images that comprise the Desert Bloom volume of Fazıl Şeyh's remarkable and utterly heartbreaking trilogy. And I really do recommend that you not only visit these images in their various locations, but that you spend some time with those three volumes as such. They're very exquisitely organized. The different relationships between caption and image does a lot of work, and everyone should spend time with them. There are other images in this volume where more certain figures can be drawn against the ground, of squat buildings, water reservoirs and agricultural activity, tented shelters with tires and metallic waste strewn across the landscape. There are also photographs of desiccated riverbeds and fire-scorched earth. Yet even in these more resolute images of still recognizable forms, the rubble and the sand function as both referent and figure for the dissolution of structure, a dissolution that has occurred and that is occurring and that is anticipated on the horizon of the status quo in Israel-occupied Palestine. The textual weave of these two levels of referent and figure, earthly sand and photographic grain, is accomplished partly by the artifice of distance. The aerial perspective dissolves in the manner of an acid bath what proximity would have disclosed in more accessible detail. The line of a ruined street, the stubble of a tree no longer irrigated by human hands, the abandoned foundation of a house, a shop, a mosque, the effaced courtyard wherein coffee once was drunk. That which was here has become ruin in the decades since the Nakba, and it is the disappearing of that previous existence that is traced in these images by virtue of distance, by virtue of distancing. The profundity of ruination that is seen from the very distance that made the visual regime of modern Israeli militarism possible approaches its maximal intensity, where it can no longer be read except at the level of residual contour, which is to say mere form. Thus, if these images, and this one in particular, invite us into something like formalism, if we find a morbid beauty in the monochromatic surfaces etched with shadow and abstract geometries, it is not because, as Walter Benjamin said and Susan Sontag repeated, that we have learned to find beauty in that which is vanishing. It is, rather, that the violently induced ruination of the Nakba has left us with form rather than formlessness, as testimony to erasure. In time, perhaps, that form will indeed surrender to formlessness, but because it has not, because there is still trace, there is the possibility of those questions with which I began. We have been provided with a caption, as I've said, but without reducing my interrogation to the demand for a caption, I still want to ask, what am I looking at? From where? Whence do I gaze? I ask these questions despite the fact that the accumulation of photographs in Fazıl Şeyh's titled and prefaced volumes prepares the way, and despite the fact that the proscenium arch of the exhibition's meta-text and the accompanying captions have overdetermined my probable reading. It would, you have to admit, be possible to imagine an image like this being produced somewhere else in the world, maybe in South Asia or some parts of West Africa. Nonetheless, in addition to the referential question, I asked myself, what makes me look? Because I do look. I look at these images, the aerial photographs, more intensely and with a more unashamed curiosity than I permit myself with Sheikh's portraits, beautiful though they are. No doubt this is an aesthetic preference of my own, a modernist predilection as much as an iconoclastic pietism. But I don't just mean to invoke my own preference. I mean to suggest that these photographs, like all good photographs, are constantly working upon the medium of photography, even as they undertake the impossible but necessary task of intervening in the discursive domain where truth claims are and must be made. As I said, the photographs in themselves produce no knowledge. Nonetheless, they provoke me in a manner that leads me to demand understanding. If I narrate this demand, it entails the translation of the question, what am I looking at, into what happened there where the photograph was made. I remind myself, I am looking at a photograph, not the world it enframes and to which it refers. Only by moving between the two discontinuous domains can we grasp what is at stake and what is necessary to make the object, the photograph that Fazıl Şeyh has made, give way to an event, the Nakba, that stretches out in time and reverberates across the socio-political field that we continue to inhabit today. In the introductory text that prefaces the first volume of the trilogy, Fazıl Şeyh describes his project, the effort to find evidence of effacement and to find what remains not only there, but elsewhere, in refugee camps and the other destinations that received the flood of refugees from now deserted spaces. Desert Bloom is a monument to displacement that lacks monumentalism. This is because monumentalism assumes the self-evidence of the form, but distrusts it at the same time, and so retreats into literality of reference. And that is precisely what the landscape photographs mock. And it's perhaps why the death's head cannot be forgotten entirely. We should nonetheless note a crucial difference between the portraits and the landscape photographs in the way in which they are captioned, or rather in the placement and the relationship between the captions and those photographs. The portraits are accompanied by narratives of expulsion and survival, with witness accounts, dates, and details of the witnessed, the lived, and the documentable life. The landscapes are accompanied with different information about large-scale processes and mass displacements. Although Sheikh notes the significant fact that many of the towns, I should say, not although, Fazıl Şeyh notes the significant fact that many of the towns he photographed have not only vanished into the sand that we see in this image, but that their names have also been erased from the cartographic representations of contemporary Israeli territory. In the end, this is why we must see from on high, from within the visual logic of Israeli militarism, as sand in the machine, as it were. For it is from there that the doubling of sand and grain becomes not merely a fortuitous effect of the artist's technology, his discipline, his perseverance, but the means for producing a displacement from one question to another, from what is this, to what happened here, and once again to what is happening here. The time of the photograph and the time of history are not identical. Unlike the photograph, history is a matter of the future.
Reading Images, that's the title of this series of discussions. And yet each of us was asked to respond to one image, an image. An impossible task. For does one not always begin to read and hence to respond elsewhere in citation? So stepping momentarily aside from the frame of this image in order to offer some context, and as such immediately betraying the act of reading an image. The image in question is from the series Independence Nakba, which both closes and in many ways inflects the entirety of the Erasure trilogy. Can everyone hear me at the back? I'm really aware of...
Good.
Yeah? Okay, good. Here, 65 diptychs juxtapose portraits of persons from both sides, so to speak, of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, with one pair for each year between 1948, the year in which the State of Israel was established, and 2013, each pair increasing in age. So we have one from 1 to 65. So as is the case across the trilogy, the event of 1948 looms heavily, its fissures still palpable. Or more specifically, the 15th of May, officially celebrated annually as Independence Day, and simultaneously mourned and commemorated unlawfully, unofficially, as a day of catastrophe, of Nakba. And it's precisely within the battle over the memory of this event that this series quietly yet forcefully takes its place. But here I'm contextualizing rather than reading, or, as is always the risk, interpolating. So returning to the image, two subjects address us. Two parallel gazes, directed not upon each other, but upon us, burdening us with the labor of looking and all its discomforts. Whilst in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a search for recognition, quote unquote, is undoubtedly at stake, there is no room for mere spectatorship here, no watching from afar as two or more communities seek the means for coexistence, or perhaps better put, co-resistance. Co-resistance, amongst other things, to the hegemony of on the one hand memory and on the other forgetfulness, imposed amnesia. Rather, it is the viewer who is forced to enter the scene. Can we ever respond to one without betraying the other? Can these gazes touch us without our reciprocal active touch? So where to place ourselves here, where in order to view the image, and I'm presuming that these two images are an image, one cannot turn one's back, one cannot take sides. So here where in order to view one, one must nonetheless remain partial to the other. But in this fraught context, can one ever remain impartial, objective? So two subjects midway through the continuum of 65 years. Young enough not to have seen the events of 1948 with their own eyes, yet old enough to have witnessed just once removed, to carry the stories of their parents and grandparents, to know the significance of 1948 and its material repercussions. Two subjects, it turns out, of roughly my own age. Narcissism creeps in inevitably. But is this not always the case when faced with a portrait? The search, if not for empathy, then at least some form of connection or identification? Given that there's one pair for pretty much each of our ages, none of us are excused. So what then is our permission, or rather, I would say, our obligation, if not to narrate, then certainly to engage? How must we, each in our own way, in our own context, respond to the politics of nation-building and myth-making? how to orient ourselves within the minimal yet enormous chasm that lies between the two parts of the images. An element of the image that I would propose harbors just as much as the portraits proper. So I'm thinking of the space between the two. This gulf that is at once a barrier, geographical, material, religious, ideological, the list goes on, and a thread of alliance. The lasting bonds that precede the act of division of 48, for instance. So, an image. Or I would venture to propose that this image is in fact but one of the 65 double elements that together make up a single image. A single portrait of a generalized condition of hypermemorialization and hyperamnesia that, unless acknowledged and responded to, risks closing down the future. So if, as we all well know, a photograph is always a punctual moment in space-time, a future anterior work of mourning, then this series slash image, somewhat arbitrarily closed, bears witness exemplarily to the passage of time, to the movement of discrete moments within history, to their potential capture and instrumentalization. But if we're speaking of history, where are the archives, the witnesses? Unlike in the previous volumes, so Desert Bloom and Memory Trace, no information is proffered. There are no captions with these images. Nameless, mute, and necessarily opaque, perhaps what these subjects bear witness to is the very impossibility of human testimony, the limits of language. An impossibility and frailty that is responded to in the previous volumes through an almost overabundance of information, pictorial and linguistic, precarious as this always remains. Through the ruins, landscapes, and faces that each time as portraits are in some way ventriloquized, clamoring towards both the poetic and the evidentiary. So here, however, if there is erasure, it is predominantly psychic and collective and always invisible, unspoken. Erasure on as a ban on mourning, commemoration, or even on resolution. But, and this is a question I'd like to just conclude with, insofar as psychic traces, unlike the material, resist not only interpretation, but also perhaps erasure, might we find here an avenue for resistance to the double erasure, the erasure of erasure, borne witness to by the previous works? Thank you.
I'd like to echo the thanks you've heard already to Fazal, to Eduardo, to Eva, and to all of you for being here this evening. You will hear other echoes in what I'm about to say, echoes of what others have said. These echoes are of course entirely unplanned in the sense that I didn't know they would be there, but in another sense, they're anything but accidental. They belong to the congregation of thoughts and preoccupations that we're all thinking about. I've looked at this picture and many other pictures in this book quite a bit since I first saw it a year or so ago. And of course, the first thing you think about, if you mainly work in words, is a word, and the word I think about is dome. Now, domes are a part of the architecture of almost every culture known to the world. And no doubt if I'd not learned from Fazal that this particular dome was in Palestine, then I wouldn't have thought of the great mosque in Cordoba. But I did learn that from this book, and I did think about the great mosque in Cordoba. But what I thought was, I thought about stone, about age, about shape, and I thought about something else, something very close to this book, but also a very material form of it. I thought about memory. I thought about the memory.
I thought about a building that is made to be a memory. A person in the audience and I was speaking just before about how all of the buildings in these photographs look as if they were made to last forever. I mean, they don't all last forever, but many of them lasted a long time. And we think of the buildings around us, which are not meant to last until tomorrow. It doesn't need a catastrophe to get rid of our buildings. It just needs a little wind, and they're gone. So that there's something about this, about the idea of building for the future, whatever the future is. And I thought this. I felt that this is a photograph of a building that's waiting. That is there. It's waiting for something. It's not a mosque. It's not a great mosque. It's not Cordoba. It's not a small mosque either. It's the shrine. It's a shrine of a sage, of Sadiya Salama. But then, of course, if it's a shrine, it's even more a place of memory. The stones wait there. They wait in their circular composition. They support arches. They are separated by small windows. If you look closely, there are cracks in the stone, marks of strain. There are signs of more recent retouches, bits of cement or plaster holding some of the bricks together. And then we can ask, we know then that the stones are waiting, but what are they waiting for? And my provisional answer is that they're waiting for us. They're waiting for us. The question is, what will we do when we arrive there? A dome, of course, if you think about it, is not just a roof. It is a shelter, but a dome is also a sort of sky, a sort of inner sky, a second sky, our sky. But why would we need another sky if we've got one already? Perhaps we need to get closer to the feeling of the etymology of the word dome, the notion of home, which Amir has spoken about. Home is something that we know most and best in a way when we've lost it. This is not an excuse for taking other people's homes away from them. And some people lose their homes under the most unfortunate circumstances. But it is the case that we need to travel a little distance from home to know what home is. And in a sense, I think this is what this building is waiting for. So what I feel about this photograph is that it's a kind of portrait of what home looks like when we're not there. At this point, of course, I need to change my lens, so to speak, or more crudely, to remember what medium we're talking about here. We're not talking about words. We're looking at a photograph, and we're not actually looking at a dome at all. We're not even looking at a photograph of a dome. We're looking at a photograph of a piece of wall, portions of two arches, a row of windows, all blocked but one, and a section of a ceiling of what we take to be a dome. We infer the dome, certainly. I probably have to infer the dome because we have to make sense of the space that we're looking at. But the act of inferring is what we do. It's our collaboration with the photograph. We actually build the dome in our minds because of what we are given, but we can only do it because of what Fazal has invited us to do. We can only do the inferring that he allows us or invites us to do. So if you notice now, thinking specifically about the photograph, there's the two-dimensional object we're looking at, and not whatever its origin was. Notice then how central the one open window is in this photograph. Not, I think, geometrically quite at the center of the frame, but still central to the picture. The other two patches of light above come, I believe, from gaps in the wall rather from the windows. That is, I take it they are not part of the design of the building. So the first effect of light comes from architectural design. The second two are the marks of time and damage, but they also let in the light. The holes, the gaps, the breaks, They do not let in the intended light of the architect, but they let in the light of historical change, the light of today, or the light of the moment of the photograph. The effect of this invasion, the light coming through the break, feels attractive precisely because three of the four windows are blocked, and the fourth of the windows has only a fraction at the top with a small piece of light coming through it, just a glimpse of light at the top of the arch. If all the windows were open, then I think the architect's light would no doubt be sufficient, and we wouldn't need the help of history and damage to let light into this picture. What's interesting is that if the windows were not blocked, we would see the light the architect intended us to see. There would still be plenty of darkness, plenty of shadow, and we would only see the light in any case during the day. We would not see it at night. This room is not the prison cell with a cold window, which appears in the poem by Mahmoud Darwish that Fazal quotes at the beginning of the book. This is not a prison cell. It's a home. It's a shrine, and it's a home. But it is a place that stands as a memory, not only of its own origins, but of the dark times that left it in the condition in which we find it. The light, then, holds the center of the photograph, we might say, both because there is so little of it and because it is the light.